Well, good evening, and welcome to a Miliband lecture, but not a run-of-the-mill one. I am delighted to have Danny Roderick here this evening. I'm also delighted to see many of my students who I sort of commanded to come here. And thank you for postponing your good night out for a couple of hours. As I said to you all, it will definitely be worth it. Danny Roderick is Professor of International Political Economy at the Kenzie School of Government at Harvard. He teaches in the school's MPA program in International Development. His research focuses on the following questions. Two questions, but extraordinarily difficult to answer. What constitutes good economic policy, question number one, and why are some governments rather better at it and adopting it than others? I suppose if we knew the answers to those questions, which we might do more of later, we would be in very far advanced. He is affiliated with a diversity of research associations, the National Bureau of Economic Research, the Center for Economic Policy Research, the Center for Global Development, the Institute for International Economics, and the Council on Foreign Relations. He has received many honors, including the Leontief Award for Advancing the Frontiers of Economic Thought in 2002. He has written several very influential articles. I won't run them all by you now, but I will just pick out In Search of the Holy Grail, Policy Convergence, Experimentation, and Economic Performance, published this year in the American Economic Review, Democracies Pay Higher Wages in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, Why Do More Open Economies Have Bigger Governments, Journal of Political Economy, and so on. His 1997 book, Has Globalization Gone Too Far?, was called one of the most important economics books of the decade, no less, in Business Week. And he's recently edited a collection called In Search of Prosperity, Analytical Narratives on Economic Growth. But there's one reason you should probably know him above all others, and that is he is, in my view, simply one of the most interesting international political economists writing today. And I have personally learned a great deal from your work, and continue to do so. It not just informs the research I do, but I find it inspiring in many respects. And so it's a particular pleasure to welcome you this evening to talk on to this theme. So please join me in giving Danny a very warm welcome.
Thank you, David, very much for a very kind introduction and the invitation. It's really nice to be here for a lot of different reasons. It's always nice to be in London. It's great to be at LSE, where I have many friends and colleagues and people I have worked with. It's very nice to see some old friends and new friends, some former students in the audience. That's great. And it's wonderful to be giving this lecture named in honor of Ralph Miliband. I actually read Ralph Miliband's probably best known book, The State and Capitalist Society, at a relatively early age, and remember being very influenced by it. And I think it may actually have played a role in my ending up as an economist eventually. So it's a pleasure and an honor for many different reasons. I'm going to be talking about globalization and what it can and does and sometimes does not do for development, and what are some of the ways in which it can be improved. I just noticed an interesting typo in the title, which I assure you was not my original work.
That's the LSE's own contribution.
Let me move to my title, which I think conveys the same idea. It may even be grammatical. I'm not sure about that hyphen, but what I'd like to do is start my talk by highlighting what are some, I think, anomalous or paradoxical features of globalization today, which, if you approach it from the perspective of most journalistic treatments, seem a little bit odd. And I'm going to run through a number of empirical facts which I think are fairly well established and which sit rather awkwardly with a conventional understanding of what globalization is doing. Let me begin with the paradox number one. This is the fact that globalization has been extremely beneficial, and we often hear the advocates of globalization tell us how many countries, by embracing trade and by taking part in world trade and by welcoming foreign investment, have managed to grow their economies and have reduced poverty. And indeed, from the perspective of development and poverty alleviation in general, the last two decades and a half have been incredible successes. In the last two and a half decades, from around 1980 on, not only has relative poverty fallen in the world, the absolute number of the poor has fallen. According to the World Bank's estimate, there are 400 million less poor people below the $1 a day poverty line today than there was in 1980. That's a striking accomplishment. Now, you can read that evidence in one way, which is to say, look how well globalization is working. To some extent, that is true, and the extent to which it is true is that clearly some of the countries that have done very well in this period have taken advantage of globalization. And I have no doubt that without fairly open world markets for goods and services and investment, that their performance would not have been as good. But the striking fact is that the countries that have done so well have played by very different rules of globalization than the globalization advocates and the ardent supporters of globalization among international institutions have tried to impose on the rest of the others. So I mentioned before the 400 million figure. It turns out that basically all those 400 million people are basically in China. It's that it's not that there aren't other countries where the number of the poor has fallen. It's just that if you take China out, that it's basically a wash. That there has been in parts of the world, in countries of the world where the poor have increased numbers, in others it has fallen, where there has been a significant dent being made is China. Of course, we see China has grown very rapidly, and now when you look at what China has done, it's quite clear that it has played by a quite different set of rules. China did not liberalize its import tariffs or its import regime in any significant way until really the early to mid-1990s. That's if you date China's increase in economic growth, as it is commonly done, from 1978. That's really 15 years after the rapid increase in its economic growth rate. While it did welcome foreign investment in special economic zones and in special kinds of activities, it always did so with very heavy dose of conditionality. For example, in many sectors, it was a precondition for foreign investors to come in to actually form joint ventures with domestic, mostly state enterprises. And that was a very important channel through which technological capacity was actually transferred to Chinese producers, some of whom eventually became so successful that they started buying up American companies, as in the case of the laptop business of IBM recently. It is true that China made a huge increase in exports by providing incentives for exports, but again, that was done in a very special kind of a regime following a very two-track non-WTO, non-World Bank set of policies. Looking with hindsight, I think a Washington-based economist would probably have a better grasp on explaining how China has performed if, instead of being the growth superstar that China has been in the last 2.5 decades, if China had failed miserably instead. Because then the Washington-based economists would say, what else do you expect? They still haven't privatized. They are still socialist economy. They have had these two-track regimes. Instead of liberalizing, they've gone this two-track regime. Instead of privatizing, they've gone township and village enterprises. And who can expect investment and trade and growth to come out of that environment? And instead, now what we're seeing is the opposite line, which is that look what globalization has done for China. Absolutely true. But not through the policies that those advocates would like other countries to follow. It is in fact striking how much that contrast is missed in some of the analysis of supposedly intelligent observers. This is table uses the grouping of countries that was done a couple of years back by the World Bank. And the World Bank wanted to show that countries that globalize do better than countries that do not. And what was their criterion for dividing countries into globalizers and non-globalizers? Well, it couldn't have been whether they had lower barriers to trade or not. Because if they had done that, some of the highest growth countries in the world would not have been in the globalizers group at all. Because the highest tariffs in this period have been in countries like China, Vietnam, India, which of course were in the camp of the star globalizers. So instead they had to resort to things like doing the distinction on the basis of exports and how much export growth these countries had achieved, which is of course is a rather silly thing to do, because when you're doing well, a lot of other things are happening, and one of those things is exports. But the issue is, what are the policy levers that governments influence, and what is our stand on these policies? And with respect to those policies, the kind of approach that the World Bank typically has is quite contrary to the policies of the most successful globalizers in this period. So I have in this table, I show you what the average tariffs in these countries has been extremely high. Most of these countries have made very heavy use of non-tariff barriers. And probably the most insulting fact of all is that Vietnam is still not a WTO member, and China until very recently was not. And we all know that had they been WTO members, or had WTO rules applied to them in the early 80s, or in the case of Vietnam in the late 80s when it was making its big strides, that they would not have been able to follow the kinds of policies that they did. Just like South Korea and Taiwan and other Southeast Asian or Asian countries did before them in the 60s and 70s by playing the game by different rules, the rules that they devised, rules that were much more conducive to their own industrial transformation and diversification. That was point number one. It is also the case that those countries that have tried to abide by the rules, that have tried to play by the rules, have actually performed worse. Worse not only relative to the Asian growth superstars, worse relative to their own experience under the supposedly bad old policies of the past. You may not be able to identify these three groups of countries in this chart. What I want to point to in this chart is the experience of Latin America. So the column in green is Latin America. The column in blue is East Asia and the Pacific. And the gray column is South Asia. Look at the period before 1980. Before 1980, Latin America maybe did not do that much better or as well as East Asia, but the gap wasn't that big. Then, of course, in the 1980s, we have the big debt crisis in Latin America. You see the negative growth rate of Latin America during this period. This is the so-called lost decade. Then, as part of all the things that changed in Latin America during the debt crisis decade, Latin America adopted the so-called Washington Consensus. In fact, the Washington Consensus is misnamed because it was really a Latin American consensus. That the Washington Consensus was so named because it was a meeting of Latin American economists and finance ministers articulating their new vision of what Latin American economic policies ought to be or has come to be. This was around 1989 or so. And I think it's fair to say that no country, no set of countries, no region in the world adopted these sets of policies around market openness, reducing barriers to international trade and investment, reducing barriers to capital flows, joining and becoming good members of, in good standing, of the World Trade Organization, and privatizing economies and stabilizing and so on, as the countries of Latin America. Now, I think by now everybody recognizes that Latin America has badly underperformed relative to expectations that most people had about a set of countries that had, would undertake so much liberalization, so much privatization, and tried so hard to actually implement these kinds of rules. With, for example, import liberalization in most countries in Latin America in 2 or 3 years, doing in 2 or 3 years what countries like Taiwan and South Korea had done in something like 20 years. That's sort of roughly the order of magnitude in terms of the speed and the extensiveness of the reforms in Latin America with respect to trade openness. You can see what happened is that Latin America is now growing not only significantly less rapidly than East Asia, more paradoxically, Latin America is now growing roughly at half the rate of what its growth rate was before 1980. Let me underscore that one more time. Before 1980, Latin American countries were protectionist. They had infant industry policies. They didn't care about fiscal balance, right? They experienced all the ills of macroeconomic populism. State enterprise ran rampant. There was not a single good thing you can say about Latin American policies by today's standards in that period. And yet their growth rate is twice as rapid and perhaps more than that. It's not just economic growth. The same is actually true about productivity growth. So if I'd actually put here, instead of GDP per capita, which is a measure of labor per GDP per labor or labor productivity roughly, if I'd put in measures of total factor productivity, you would see exactly the same kind of picture as well. Financial globalization. This is by now well known. I don't need to repeat it. The promise of financial globalization was that it was going to allow a transfer of savings from countries where there was a lot of savings, that's the rich countries, and where returns to those savings were low, to poorer countries where there was inadequate savings and where it was presumed that the returns to investment would be higher. So the basic driving force behind financial globalization was that it was going to be a way whereby resources could be transferred from the north to the south, augment the domestic saving effort of the developing countries, and thereby result in higher investment effort in the south. That has simply not happened. On net, the net resource transfers have not increased on average during this period. Investment rates, as you would guess from the slide that I just showed you, in those countries that opened themselves up to financial globalization, the investment rates in those countries are not any higher today. They're in fact lower than they were in the days before financial globalization. And of course, we've experienced a series of very, very costly financial crises in those countries that have left themselves open, particularly to short-term capital flows. We've had a series of crises in Mexico, in Argentina, of course, the well-known Asian financial crisis, several in Turkey, Russia, and many others, actually, as you can see in this table. I think this was unexpected. Another consequence of this has been that governments have had to respond to these financial crises by investing in very costly mechanisms of what's called self-insurance. One of the determinants of whether countries fall into financial crises or not, whether financial panics happen or not, is the amount of central bank reserves that governments hold in relation to short-term debt. So it has become an advice of good central banking that central banks should not let their central bank reserves to short-term debt ratio to fall below one. So what that means is that every time a private entity, a corporate entity or a bank, private bank in a developing country, borrows short-term from financial markets, the central bank has got to turn around and increase its reserve assets by $1. Not only does that mean that there is no net resource transfer to the developing countries once you aggregate up what the private sector has done and what the public sector has done, there is a tremendous loss on account of the spread between the cost of borrowing for that country and the return that the central bank gets on its reserve assets, because the central bank holds its reserve assets in very short-term U.S. Treasury securities and a number of other securities. These are highly liquid. That's the whole point. You want to hold liquid assets so that you have mechanisms to intervene. But the prices that these are have very low return. So you're talking about a country that has the cost of borrowing of perhaps 12-15%, but might hold reserve assets that are paying interest of 3-5%. And the gap for that is the loss that that country incurs for every dollar of short-term borrowing that the private sector engages in. You can see the huge increase in foreign reserves that countries have had to hold subsequent to the spread of financial globalization. And what's striking here, this is what I've shown here, is the ratio of foreign reserves to months of imports. And the before financial globalization, central banks held reserves purely as a smoothing mechanism for imports, for commercial purposes, and not for purposes of preventing financial crises. And the rule was that you should hold reserves that amounted to about 3 months of imports. And you can see that up until the late 1980s, that rule pretty much held, that central banks were holding reserves equivalent to about 3 months of imports. And that was true of industrial and developing countries. But look at what happens subsequently. Developing countries start to increase their holding of reserves. That's their investment in the United States. And whereas the developed countries, the industrial countries, basically do nothing. So it's the difference is entirely one between developing and industrial countries. And what's the cost of that? Here is the true social cost for developing nations of this investment that they're undertaking. So this is basically the cost of borrowing at high interest rates and investing at low interest rates that these countries are incurring. By 2004, this amounted to roughly 1.2% of GDP of developing countries. Let me just be clear what that number is. That's the annual transfer from developing countries to the governments of rich countries as the price to be paid for insuring themselves against financial crises. The third point I would like to make is just so that you don't think I'm a rabid anti-globalizer, is that some of the areas in terms of globalization where the gains are demonstrably the largest are, for some reason, the areas that get the least amount of attention. If you were to take a bunch of economists, put them around the table, and say, what is the area where you can get the biggest bang in terms of overall economic welfare for the world and for developing countries by reducing the corresponding barriers in that area? The answer would have to be restrictions on the mobility of workers across countries. And that is follows from a very simple principle in economics, which is that the gains from liberalizing any market are rising in the size of the wedge between price differentials in different parts of that market. That is to say, basically when you're liberalizing your services trade or your import trade or your capital trade, your investment trade, where the gains come from is the fact that there are differences in the prices of goods in different markets, and the gains, the efficiency gains, arise from arbitraging those differences. Well, where are those differences the largest in the world? They are in labor markets. And to just give you a sense of the magnitude, that a rough calculation is that a relatively small relaxation in restrictions on temporary labor mobility in the world. And what I mean, let me be clear, that this is an increase in the amount of developing country workers allowed in the rich country markets of about 3 percentage points of those countries' total labor force. So this is not, I'm not at all talking about free labor mobility. I'm just talking about increasing the number of poor country workers in the rich country markets by 3 percentage points of rich country workforce. That amounts to, by a conservative estimate, my own estimate is actually higher than this, but I'm relying with the estimate made by Alan Winters, of $80 billion per annum. Yeah. Now compare that with the latest estimate from the World Bank of what would be the total gains to developing countries from removing all restrictions in agriculture, in trade, in manufacturers, right? And that's about $22 billion annually. This $22 billion is more than what's on the agenda at Doha currently. So that's, we're talking about the upper bound on what Doha can accomplish. And then you can ask yourself, have we allocated the talent in terms of our trade negotiators and everything else that goes with that appropriately in terms of the areas where there's actually the biggest gain to enhancing the efficiency and enhancing economic performance around the world? Now, there are lots of issues with regard to temporary labor mobility, and I'm happy to talk about that if there are questions. For now, I just want to make the point that it is simply not the case that the agenda of what is it that we work on when we talk about enhancing globalization and reducing barriers around the world, it is certainly not the case that what we're working on is where the biggest gains are. And that should not be a surprise because anybody who's looked at how the World Trade Organization or the IMF operates is that what gets on the agenda is typically driven very much by the interest of some key players. So it wasn't a surprise that financial services in the Uruguay round became a big issue because American Express got interested in financial services. It's not a big surprise that TRIPS became part of the World Trade Organization because pharmaceutical companies got interested. Okay? Trade has become such a big issue because large multinational companies see big benefits in market access abroad and therefore have lobbied their governments to get other countries to reduce their import barriers. The reason that labor mobility hasn't become such a big issue is an interesting political economy question. My quick answer would be that it's much harder to mobilize future employers who don't yet see the benefits of the workers who would come in because they cannot actually yet identify very clearly where the benefits would be. And in those areas where you do see the benefits, such as information technology, where companies do understand the benefits from being able to hire workers from India, there, in fact, you have gotten changes, because then you have high-tech companies in the Silicon Valley in the United States lobbying the federal government, making sure that the visa allocations are expanded so they can have access to workers from India. The last, just want to make sure it was the last, paradox is that this is not just a developing country issue. That after all I've said, one can walk away with the sense that, look, this globalization is just a north-south thing, that basically there are all these rules that developing countries that aren't really very good for developing countries, and that it's really a north-south issue. But I do want to, even though this is not really my subject today, I do want to make the point that this is also an issue in the north. That is, it's not the case that globalization is something that has caught the imagination of people in the north or in the industrial countries. And what is striking is that when you ask the question, do you favor that imports ought to be restricted to protect the national economy, basically, without exception, in all industrial countries in the world, there is a majority of respondents who either agree or agree strongly with the view that imports ought to be restricted. So here I've identified the U.S. and Great Britain. So basically, if you look at the last two columns, the respondents in Great Britain who are pro-trade are about 14% of the population, or the sample. Against trade are 63%, and the proportions are very very similar in the United States. That's another, I think, fundamental political economy paradox, that if we have had so much trade liberalization in the world, it is not because trade liberalization is a popular thing. It's because this agenda has been very aptly led by certain interests, and who have been able to get this agenda adopted. Any time trade becomes a more politically salient issue, you run into problems, or whenever political elites get engaged with other issues and don't put trade or globalization-related issues very high on their agenda. Okay, let me now turn to some arguments that I think are going to hopefully turn something that has been, I hate to say this, but I at one point I thought I sounded like Joe Stiglitz a lot, which is sort of just, go on about all these ills around and the world, and I just, I want to turn this around and just, put a little bit of a frame around these facts and suggest what are some of the ways in which we can make sense of these things. The first point that I want to make, I think, is an important point that may seem a little bit distant from the issues that I've talked about, but I think it's a fundamental theoretical point with lots of implications, and I'll come back to how this ties with some of the empirical facts that I've made. The claim is that when we talk about globalization, we talk about reducing barriers to trade in goods, trade in services, trade in assets, and as we have reduced them over time, what we have found is that there are other reasons why economic activity diminishes once it reaches national borders, that there is something about national sovereignty that severely restricts trade across national borders, regardless of the height of the actual border barriers. And the claim that I'd like to make is that the reason for that is that national borders in and of themselves is a source of trade barrier. It is a source of barrier because national borders create jurisdictional discontinuities. And what that means is that it raises the costs of doing business in all kinds of different ways. It raises the cost of enforcing contracts. It raises the cost of complying by different national standards and product regulations. It raises the cost of ensuring that the legal authority will act impartially when it is a dispute between a domestic and a foreign party. It raises the costs in all kinds of different ways, and we see that in a whole lot of studies, which have found that despite the disappearance of formal border barriers in the form of import tariffs or non-tariff barriers, that border effects remain strong. So there's this well-known phenomenon of missing trade in the literature on international trade. Missing trade refers to the idea that countries are trading a lot less with each other than what theory says they should. Another aspect of this is the finding that two Canadian provinces trade between 5 or 20, depending on the study that you want to look at, between 5 and 20 times more with each other than they do with a U.S. state across the border that's equidistant. Yeah? And if you actually try to look for formal trade barriers between U.S. and Canada, you'd really find it very hard to actually identify any. The fact that there are these border barriers is not due to what we think of the formal trade restrictions. Somehow, the borders delineating national sovereignty are themselves creating these transactional costs. We also see this in small net capital flows. So I've mentioned already that despite this tremendous financial globalization and huge explosion in gross assets flows, that the actual net capital flows, the net resource transfers, have remained small. Now, in the case of trade, the transactions cost created by regulatory and jurisdictional discontinuities are estimated to have raised trade costs by around 40%. So what that is saying, that after you've gotten rid of all your import tariffs and non-tariff barriers, those borders are equivalent still to about a 40% tariff. There's virtually no country in the world today that actually has 40% tariff. Even China has come way below that. So that's really talking about very high trade barriers. In the case of capital flows, The transactions costs arise from the non-existence of many institutions that span national borders that we take now for granted within national economies. So there's the problem of sovereign risk, the fact that if the borrower refuses to pay you, that there's no international court you can go to actually enforce that contract if the borrower happens to be a sovereign borrower, a government. Try taking Argentina to court when Argentina decides that it would rather not pay foreign borrowers when it has run out of money. There's the problem that there is no international lender of last resort. That is to say that when panic develops, there is no international institution that stands ready to lend at will to countries that are actually experiencing that financial panic, performing the role that central banks do in the national setting to ensure that the financial system works smoothly. So the fact that you do not have these that monetary institutions that play and fiscal institutions that and legal institutions that play a huge role in stabilizing financial systems domestically do not span borders means that at that border you have these huge transactions costs which result in capital flows remaining small in net terms and also result in financial instability of the kind of crises that I talked about before. So first point is that we have to understand that because we're a world of different nation states, it doesn't matter how much nation states reduce their formal trade barriers, their existence in and of itself is a limit to how far globalization can go. Second point to make is to realize that institutional diversity is in itself desirable. So the conclusion to take from what I just said is not therefore that the way to further economic integration is to try to ensure that these institutional discontinuities are as small as possible and to harmonize regulations and laws, but to understand that those differences, this institutional diversity, plays a useful function. Normatively, what we need to understand is that part of the reason for this institutional diversity is that we cannot talk in general about a set of institutional designs that have optimal characteristics that the way to put it best is to say that while we can think of the functions that useful institutions perform, so we can say that good institutions, for example, will protect property rights, they will enforce contracts, good institutions will maintain macroeconomic stability, they will provide market-oriented incentives, they'll achieve outward orientation, okay? But the way that I've defined these functions of institutions says nothing about the form that those institutions take. So that when we try to map those institutional functions to the forms that the institutions have to take or the blueprints for those institutions, I would claim that there's no unique mapping. That is to say, all those institutional functions can be achieved in a multiplicity of different ways. There are different institutional arrangements that can end up producing the same kinds of outcomes. Within the rich countries, I think we see that in the wide diversity of institutions in corporate governance, financial markets, labor markets, product market regulation, that despite their differences, have produced the roughly comparable amounts of wealth for the countries where they operate. So Japan, in the United States, in Europe, of course, in Europe there's a difference between the Scandinavians and the Rhinish model, if you will. And these differences have all resulted despite our preoccupation in the last few years about sort of, you know, periodically we always think that there is a set of best practice institutions, you know, memories tend to be short. We forget in the 1980s everybody looked at Japan as the ultimate, you know, best set of institutions. But over the long haul, what we can say is that the empirical evidence is that that the institutional underpinnings of markets can be provided in a number of different ways. And differences in social preferences, differences in history, that's the role played by path dependence, and different needs arising due to differences and the levels of economic development and therefore the cost of maintaining different types of institutional arrangements at different levels of development, all imply that this institutional diversity is going to be grounded in some real needs that different countries have. Okay, so if trying to look at these transactions costs at the border as something that you need to grind down as much as you can, I think is the way that, that some trade economists sometimes do, as when the trade negotiation agenda becomes one not simply about border barriers, but going beyond them to an agenda of what some kind of calls a deep economic integration agenda that's really reaching beyond behind borders to regulate, to harmonize regulations and so forth. I think that's an agenda that's fundamentally ignores what I have just said and what I'm arguing with this slide, that this diversity has real useful purpose. Now, that doesn't mean that a set of countries, like the members of the European Union, cannot come together and decide that they are sufficiently similar, that their goals are sufficiently similar, that the levels of development are sufficiently similar, that they would actually benefit from deeper economic integration in that way. And that in fact is precisely, I think, the rationale for why true economic integration in European Union does require the some political, federal or confederal vision. And that's why I think the acquis communautaire, as much as one might hate all of its detail, actually is a need for further deep economic integration. So that's there's a clear realization there. But I think it's a pipe dream to believe that the rest of the world can be part of a similar kind of a legal and political community. And therefore, the rest of the world has got to choose whether they're going to be going down a path which is very costly in pursuit of something that is actually not very attainable, which is deep economic integration. Let me turn to issues of economic growth, and I'll link it again with this point about institutional diversity and points about the designs about globalization. I started out by talking about countries that had done well and how I said our countries that had done well had sort of played by different rules. Okay. This is another take at the same question. Okay. You can look and read at the slide, and you'll probably figure out which are the two countries I'm talking about. This is a story about two countries. One country has not only free, has actually preferential market access to the United States for all of its exports, can send several millions of its citizens to work in the United States, therefore receives huge remittances inflows, also receives a huge volume of direct investment from the United States, is not only all of that, actually also manages to have the U.S. Treasury stand as the lender of last resort and a guarantor of its financial stability. It's hard to think of a case where globalization could actually get any better, right? Then consider this other country, which actually faces all kinds of market access barriers abroad. The U.S. maintains a trade embargo in it. It receives neither aid or any other kind of assistance from the rich nations or the multilateral institutions. It's kept outside World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization and cannot borrow from those. Okay. You probably guessed that the first country is Mexico. The second country is Vietnam until 1994, 1995. So between 1987 and 1994, Vietnam did not have diplomatic relations, did not have market access, and was kept out of the IMF and the World Bank. And you ask the question, which country did better? There's no comparison. No comparison. Per capita GDP has grown in Vietnam since 87, or if you want to just take only this period, 87 to 94, about 5% per capita GDP per annum. In this period in Mexico, I think the number is around 1%. Real wages have fallen in Mexico. They have taken off in Vietnam. Inequality has greatly increased in Mexico. So what's the point? I mean, the point really is ultimately what happens to you is determined by what you do to yourself. With all the advantages of market access, access to financial flows, and access to the U.S. market, and being able to send your workers abroad and so forth, Mexico simply did not get its did not do its job right. Vietnam did that, and by the way, there are countries at different levels of income, and you can say, well, you know, it's not entirely clear which way it should have worked, but I can certainly give you countries in Central America which are more comparable to Vietnam and which have had a similar experience. I think fundamentally the difference is between a country which self-consciously fashioned an economic policy that was targeted at diversifying its economy and upgrading its production structure, and doing it in ways that were very pragmatic, listening to Western advice when it made sense, and not listening when it did not make sense, and not paying too much attention to what Western economists said. And a country that had very well-trained PhDs from Harvard and MIT running their economies, I'm afraid to say, and who basically bought into a particular ideology of how economic policy ought to be conducted, based largely on ideology rather than any evidence or any good theory, and therefore I think neglected the task of economic transformation that a proactive policy really requires, and the task of transformation in Mexico was left to the maquila sector. And the advantages that that were obtained through NAFTA, which benefited tremendously in certain sectors of the Mexican economy and created huge boom in Mexican exports, but actually did not produce overall economic growth and did not produce overall productivity growth for the economy as a whole. So it remained very limited. So when it comes to improving your economic circumstances, domestic policies trump everything else, including what your trade partners are doing or what the global rules are. And the corollary to that is that if that's your vision of, if that's your starting point, it also follows that you need to have the space, you need to have the room within which you can actually fashion your own pragmatic response, your own pragmatic policy agenda, your own pragmatic restructuring policies that will get you that those outcomes. It can't be that you're working off of a blueprint that's designed somewhere else. And I think what we are seeing is actually a change in the conception of economic policy and growth strategies that is beginning to incorporate that. So we have a movement away from a Washington consensus style of thinking on economic policy, which is to say, here is 10 things that every country has got to do, and once they do them, they'll all grow. Now, that original Washington consensus became the second generation reforms, which the only difference from the Washington consensus was that instead of 10 things, you had 30 things that you had to do. And the additional 20 things were much harder things. And because they were much harder, you can always turn around and say, aha, you did not do, you know, you did only 29 of them. And the 30th, only if you had done it well enough, then you would have grown. And that's the reason you did not do it. We're moving away from that kind of agenda, which is one, I think, that is much more specific, much more based on the idea that what we call binding constraints to economic growth might differ from setting to setting. In some countries, it might be that the problem is with a very poor investment environment. There, what you want to look at is why that is the case. It may be that the investment environment is poor because the government is doing something badly. Then you want to address that constraint. Or the investment environment might be bad because the markets aren't working very well. Then you want to address those market imperfections. It could be that you're in an environment where the problem is not with the investment environment, but it's with the cost of capital. The economy is teeming with entrepreneurs wanting to invest, but what they cannot get access to is financing. Well, in those kinds of economies, you don't want to do any of the other things that I just talked about. What you want to do is find ways of removing that financing constraint. And then you have to ask the question, where is that financing constraint? Now, that way of thinking, it's a diagnostic way of thinking. It accepts that different countries have different, at any point in time, face different binding constraints. And you look for the kind of diagnostic signals that different types of constraints throw out. For example, if investment is constrained by unavailability of finance in a situation where there is high investment and entrepreneurial demand, what you will see is high real interest rates. Example, Brazil. Brazil is a country where you cannot go and say the problem is with a poor investment environment first and foremost, because as you can see from a huge real interest rate, even at real interest rates of 20%, you have tons of entrepreneurs who want to invest. The problem is with the high real interest rates, with high cost of capital. So you don't go into that country like the World Bank does and say, you need to fix your investment environment. Look how many days it takes to open up a business. Well, whatever, however big a problem that might be, it's clearly not Brazil's problem right now. No matter how many days there are still entrepreneurs wanting to do that. And then you go to another country, El Salvador, for example, is an example where my colleagues have worked, where the problem is not that at all. Banks are dying to find customers to lend money to, and there's no borrower. And the issue is with investment demand, is with lack of entrepreneurship. And then you ask, is that because of something the government is doing wrong? Is it because the markets are working wrong? Well, our answer in the case of El Salvador was that it wasn't mostly what the government was doing wrong. It was mostly that markets were not throwing appropriate signals for investments in new areas. But the point I want to make is that I try to illustrate with these examples is that in different setting, different constraints are going to throw different signals, and the task of a growth agenda, a growth policy, is going to be to match your policy priorities with the diagnostics of the type that I just did. And when you do that, you do your job well, what you'll find is that sometimes the best way that you can alleviate constraints is by working in highly heterodox ways. So when China faced the problem of how do you provide incentives to poor farmers to engage in production, they did not go and do an across-the-board liberalization, which is what Western economists would have told them. Instead, they did a two-track liberalization, where they liberalized at the margin while keeping the revenue streams unchanged inframarginally. That meant that you did not have to suffer the public finance consequences of across-the-board liberalization, which would have been very, very severe. When China faced the problem of providing incentives for investment in industry, it did not totally privatize enterprise, Instead, it found out that something called township and village enterprises worked very well, and it ended up promoting that, even though it was not a form of private ownership. I don't want to say that these are examples for other countries to follow. The basic thinking and logic and attitude behind them is the approach that other countries ought to follow, which is to think about binding constraints and to think about institutional innovations that are cognizant of the domestic reality that can achieve these effects, sometimes in highly divergent, heterodox ways. Okay, so I will conclude to be in a way that like to be perhaps haven't been very controversial so far. So I'd like to end hopefully on a more controversial note and suggest 10 concrete things that I think would make the world more conducive to development. And you see that many of them will actually follow from the discussion that I've provided, although some are somewhat different. Number one, I would really put at the top of my agenda this idea of temporary labor mobility. A temporary work permit scheme that would allow workers from developing nations to spend, let's say, 3 to 5 years in the advanced countries. Okay. What I think is important is to make sure that this is a temporary scheme, so there's a revolving set of workers. There's an issue of how you make that temporary. If you have questions, I can try to address that. I would not limit it to only high-skilled workers. I would actually design it such that there's a mix of low and high-skilled workers. But that, I think, has to be at the core of any future truly development truly development-oriented agenda of negotiations for the World Trade Organization. Number two, one of the biggest source of transfers from the developing countries to rich countries is the subsidization of direct foreign investment. And I think a multilateral agreement that bans the subsidization of direct foreign investment is not only will reduce that transfer, will actually enhance efficiency. It's as I say in parentheses, it's really striking that subsidization of FDI is the only significant form of industrial policy that is not banned currently under the existing rules of best behavior, either explicitly by the World Trade Organization or implicitly in the policy conditionality of the multilaterals. Third, a second big issue in the context of the development, any truly development-oriented world WTO agenda, would be to explicitly recognize this issue of policy space that I've talked about, which is that truly successful growth strategies will require developing countries to have the freedom and the autonomy and the space to develop and employ policies that will often conflict with international disciplines with international disciplines as we understand them today and as we've been constructing them today. So what I would suggest is a development box in the WTO that goes substantially beyond simply agriculture, that includes the use includes manufacturers trade, that would legitimize the use of trade and industrial incentives, including export subsidies. And if there's any question, I'll come back to that. For development purposes. And I would say that the burden of proof that the intervention is not developmental would have to be on the complainant, not on the recipient of the complaint. Okay. Fourth, I think this is another sort of area where more work needs to be done. That the in northern governments need to be willing to share information on bank accounts with regard to the deposits held by developing country residents. Okay, this is in terms of the overall tax base of the poor countries, whether it is actually illegal or whether it's simply tax evasion. I think developing country governments should have the ability to find out information of this sort. Okay. Well, financial transactions tax on foreign currency transactions. So the Tobin tax. I don't think the Tobin tax will actually do much to to smooth financial cycles or prevent financial crises. But what they will certainly do is raise a whole lot of revenue. And I would target a financial transaction task of a tax of a small amount, a 0.1 percentage point, and with proceeds spent on global public goods, on public health and environment and other things. Again, purely from a revenue standpoint, and not from the standpoint of reducing the severity of financial crises, on which I'll come in a second. I think the argument that this will reduce the efficiency of the functioning of the world financial system is just an outlandish idea. Okay, six, I'm getting there. Now that's the, I think in some sense, what's more important from the perspective of reducing both the incidence and when they occur, their severity of financial crisis, is that I think that a recognition, in particular by the U.S. Treasury, that prudential restrictions on capital flows, what one might call politely capital account management, if you don't want to call them capital controls, that such policies or such management is an integral part of a country's developmental policies. This is a proposal that comes from my colleague Michael Kramer, but I like it a lot. It's the odious debt notion, which is that debt contracts signed by oppressive regimes should no longer be enforceable in northern courts. And there should be an ex ante, an announcement of which are those odious regimes, so that any private lender, or any private entity that signs a contract with a heavily repressive dictatorial entity knows that that contract is not going to be ex post enforceable in international contracts, international courts. Eight, preparation of a developmental impact statement is a necessary requirement for any international agreement, including the costing out of the financial implications for developing countries. Now, one of the things that often happens in international negotiations is that they end up imposing all kinds of obligations on developing countries with promises to provide financial assistance for their implementation. And the financial assistance often does not materialize. This clearly happened in the Uruguay round, where there's a whole range of institutional obligations that were imposed on developing countries. Michael Finger, for example, of the World Bank, has calculated that purely the administrative costs of implementing things like the Customs Valuation Agreement or the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement in poor countries amounts to something like their total developmental budget. So this seems to me to be a clearly inappropriate prioritization of where you want to spend your institutional and financial and budgetary resources. And for that purpose, I think it would be very helpful if any time that there are requirements that developing countries do this or that, there's an explicit costing out of what that is going to cost, an explicit laying out of how exactly it's going to be paid and financed. Okay, this is an idea I like a lot, has no chance happening, which is one of the unfortunate features of in today's world is the near monopoly of the World Bank in terms of generating and disseminating policy advice and ideas. And what I would do is I would try to really create competition for policy ideas. And any way that you can create that competition for policy ideas would be good. You can break up the World Bank into competing agencies. Let developing countries choose which multilateral lending agency they want to borrow from and have conditionality with. Because after all, you know, they have the right incentive. They want the money to come and be useful, because otherwise markets will not treat them well anyhow. So it seems to me that this is an area where competition would be good. Finally, I haven't said much about the IMF. Here it is. I would take the IMF's Policy Development and Review Department, which is the part of the IMF that implements this orthodoxy, and would put it in an African capital, and I would rotate it among different African capitals for every 5 years, I think would make a huge difference to the way that the IMF works if its staff actually spent some real time in those capitals. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, that was a tour de force by any standard. I mean, I think it was a tour de force in terms of research and scholarship you brought to the lecture, in terms of clarity, and in terms of advocacy. I won't compare and contrast you to the other economists you mentioned, but when he was there, certainly the clarity and advocacy was in the end much less clear. So I think the audience and I are deeply appreciative of what was an outstanding lecture. Now, I know a few of you have to go for various reasons. Please go quietly now, but I wouldn't like to waste any time on getting questions going. Danny was right, we usually take them in clusters of four or five. Is that all right? Just so the audience has a chance to get some issues on the table. Already there's a queue down here, so I'll start briefly down here and take two or three, then up there. Yes, please. We've got mics. We'll come to you.
And I would like you to tell a bit more about the working permits for developing workers.
Robert Wade, sorry, we'll come back in just a second.
Danny, how do you explain the paradox of China? It is said that private property rights are a necessary condition for vast growth. China has had vast growth without appearing to have what we would recognize as private property rights. How do you explain that? Secondly, what is the difference between your approach and conclusions and those of Joe Stiglitz?
Well, I was referring to Stiglitz in my remarks earlier, yes. James Putzel.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciated your talk. I wanted to make one comment and one quick ask you to comment on an observation. First, the historical story, I think, is probably more dire than you say, because liberalization in fragile African states at a certain point was the knockout blow, in a way, in relationship to state collapse. And this is a proposition we're investigating at the Crisis States Research Center, but I'd like you perhaps to reflect on that. But secondly, I really like your 10 reforms, but I think there are some very, very strong points of political opposition which I'd like you to comment on. The first one in relationship to labor migration. If anything, the mood of the day with the war on terror, et cetera, is to restrict movements and to restrict the repatriation of earnings. And then we'll come up with very perverse formulas like the one coming out of the British government right now around bonded labor, which would be interesting if you talked about. And on the other hand, in relationship to the banks, you know, Tom Naylor from McGill wrote a book once called The Politics of Hot Money and the International Debt, where he documented just how competitive banks have been in attracting the flight capital from developing countries. So there's going to be great resistance, I think.
I'll take a couple more from down here, and then we'll get Danny to respond, and then the rest from the top. So down here, yes, you've been waiting. And then Kevin.
Yeah, you used to write about quality growth. What I missed in the course of the talk was the D word. I didn't actually notice whether countries which were performing better or worse were more or less democratic. And in fact, some of those who appeared to be performing better were profoundly undemocratic, and vice versa.
And then, Ken, over there, one more, and then we'll stop for a moment, get Danny to respond, and then it comes.
Thanks. Yeah, I enjoyed your talk as well, but I wanted to push you on something where I think I may be seeing an inconsistency or a tension, and see if you can clarify it for us. On the one hand, you have a very compelling argument that what we care about are the functions that are important for growth, and those don't map onto institutions. So different institutions can get its different functions. But when you look back at your example of pretty impressive growth in Latin America in the first period, say 1960s, post-World War II until the early 1980s, an argument could be made that they didn't have the functions either, or the institutions. They didn't have secure property rights. As you said, they did everything wrong according to, you know, what we think about what you need to do. And so I'm wondering how you explain that period. Do you explain Latin America in that period as the way you explain China now? They're actually doing it right, but they're doing it right in their own ways. Or are you implicitly saying that actually those functions that we now claim are so important really aren't that important, because you can do pretty darn well with crappy private property rights, you know, fiscal populism, and the rest of the sort of the things that all the Latin Americans did wrong so well for so many years?
Okay, thank you. That's several questions already, but there are people up there who will feel very hurt if we don't get to them. So,
okay,
5 minutes.
That's a big agenda. I appreciate the questions. Maybe you'll allow me to be a little bit selective and maybe go over rather quickly over, but the number of big questions have been asked. On labor mobility, the economic case for labor mobility is very clear, which is that it's no different from liberalizing trade in goods. And furthermore, it's demonstrably a bigger deal in terms of the increase in incomes it would generate for those people who are the beneficiaries of this. And the real big gains are not the remittances. The big gains are the incomes that accrue to people who are actually able to work at much higher wages. They're essentially the same people. They have the same skills. It's just that they can make 5 to 8 or 10 times more in advanced industrial countries. Now, I think that the reason I emphasize temporariness is I think there is the need to ensure that it's always going to be a lottery, but you can expand the size of the lucky ones by having revolving a number of people who are able to take advantage of this. Plus, there is the fact that returning workers might be able to bring significant amount of human capital and resources and knowledge about how things are done and international markets and so forth with them when they return. So I think there might be significant spillovers to back home when there was return. Now, the immediate question that arises there is whether return, is that actually realistic? That there would be return. I would say that we've had many so-called temporary worker programs. Germany's program was explicitly called the guest worker program, and of course, you know, as we know, many in fact have stayed on. But I would say that there was, you know, ex ante, it would have been, one ought to have been able to predict that, because there's actually nothing in those schemes that provided either any incentives or any disincentives for people to return or stay. So what I would say is that it would be entirely legitimate, for example, to make these temporary worker schemes be such that they come with a forced saving scheme. That is, a certain amount of earnings are blocked in accounts that become available only upon return. Furthermore, I would say that I would link each sending country's quota to the proportion of the workers that they're able to actually return, or what proportion, to what extent they're able to fulfill their quota of the return. And you can easily imagine that would actually set forth some powerful incentives for governments with a queue of people at home waiting to be on that line of moving to and make those income differences, that they would have an incentive to make their own country relatively hospitable for that kind of return, for the workers to actually want to return,
as opposed to not want to return. So I think one can think of various incentives, both for the sending countries and for the workers themselves, to actually increase. I don't think we'll ever have 100% return, but I think we can. One of the striking things about workers is if you ask them where they want to live, they retain significant amount of attachment to their home countries. Now, on the political side, I think the point that was made is that this is obviously politically not very popular, but I would say several things in return. One is that there's actually things happening which is making it politically more palatable. One is, of course, the demographic transition in the advanced countries and the need for a larger worker base to finance pensions of retirees. And in fact, that's actually playing itself out, and there's significant advantages to having foreign workers come in. Then there are certain sectors where there's sort of perceived shortages, like in the IT sector, where it has a... But fundamentally, we have to understand that the underlying distributional effects of labor mobility is no different from trade. Is that it doesn't matter whether you're importing the services of labor from the Philippines by importing garments from the Philippines, or whether you're actually importing the workers directly from the Philippines. It has exactly the same impact on wages in the importing country. And therefore, there is no logical argument to be made that it's okay to liberalize trade while saying that, but when it comes to labor mobility, no, that's socially, the distributional effects of that are too costly. I don't want to diminish the importance of the issues, and I think there's a lot that still needs to be thought about that. All that I'm claiming is relative to the magnitude of the effects in terms of overall income effects of this, that there is significantly less work going on and significantly less policy attention being paid to it compared to, you would think that the world would come to an end if the Doha round collapses in Hong Kong. Well, the fact is nothing will happen if there's no conclusion, no successful conclusion in Doha. Nothing will happen except if we actually take those things, to predictions, as self-fulfilling predictions, and people actually act thinking that something terrible has actually happened. Because there's simply not that much at stake. And no matter what you read elsewhere, maybe somebody else will ask me a question on that later on, and I can elaborate on that. Private property rights versus what happened in China. Now, this is really interesting. So, as Robert was saying, here's an economy where you didn't have formal private property rights. Township and village enterprises were remarkably successful. In fact, they were the driving force of economic growth in China until the mid-1990s, roughly sort of between the early to mid-80s to sort of the mid-1990s. They really drove the process of economic growth. You have to think once again about what's key in terms of my functions that you want good institutions to perform. It's not private property rights. Why do you want them? You want them because you want investors to have security. You want them because investors feel that they will get return, that when they make a return on their investment, that they can appropriate them, that nobody else is going to stick in. Well, private property rights is one way you achieve that. But how does private property rights work? It works by establishing a legal system and a court system so that if somebody steps in and takes your money away from you, you appeal to a court system, and the court interferes and says to that person, no, you can't do that. That's the way the private property rights system works. Now, Russia tried to do that in the early 1990s by doing across-the-board property rights reform by saying, well, this is private property rights, this is what we're going to do. It did not work. Did it provide security of property rights? It did not, because you cannot overnight establish a judiciary and a court system. So even though you had it in name, you did not have it in practice, because no investor could actually go to a competent, honest court and expect the rights to be, as an investor, to be protected. So investors in Russia were not feeling protected, even though they had a formally private property rights regime in existence. Now, why did the TVEs work in China? Well, who is going to expropriate the investors in these TVEs? It's the local governments. And if you make the investors partners with the local government, then by turning them into residual claimants on the stream of profits, then you ensure that as long as times are good, as long as there is an expectation of enough future profits, that there is a, in game theoretic terms, there is a an equilibrium with repeated interactions where the best strategy for the local government is not to expropriate the entrepreneur, let the entrepreneur invest, and the best strategy for the entrepreneur is to keep on investing. And here you have a system that can work, provides secure property rights to the entrepreneur, because the entrepreneur knows that the only possible expropriator is actually his partner. And as long as the entity is making money, has value for the future, the expropriator doesn't want to expropriate. Why kill the source of future profits? I don't want to say anything about. So that's, I think, a very good example of how you can have sort of security of property rights under the specific conditions of China, achieved through a very different kind of mechanism. But this explanation makes clear that it's not something that's going to transfer to another setting. So in another setting, you have to do the thinking from scratch again, which is one advantage that China had, that being a big country, they actually experiment a lot and then find out what was working. So I think this kind of experimentation is easier for rich countries, I mean for large countries, but still has got to be part of the way you think about policy reform and institutional reform, I think, in all settings. I don't want to say something about, there was a point made that liberalization enhanced the collapse of African state. I would need to think more about that. I haven't thought about it. So I'd be curious to see the work on that. Let me tie what I just said on China with the question on Latin America. The question was asked whether it's the case that in Latin America all those bad policies were not actually even performing the functions that we want good institutions to perform. I would say no. I mean, just as in my example with property rights in China, those old policies of import protection and infant industry promotion, they essentially, what they told investors in the home market was, look, you know, our policy is such that you invest in these enterprises, you invest in these, you know, inward-oriented industries, and we're going to protect you, we'll allow you to make profits. So there was a particular, there was effective security of property rights in certain kinds of investments. So you got most countries of the region, not all, you did get that investment response. Now, you didn't have many other institution elements that are desirable, and therefore this wasn't the perfect system. So where you did not get macroeconomic stability, you did not get a lot of investment and growth, as in some of the countries of the region. But I would say that earlier experience is not only not contrary, I think it reinforces my point that there is this variety of ways in which you can produce these outcomes. Some of them are more costly, some of them are less costly. Finally, on democracy and growth, thank God for India. and thank God for India in the last quarter century, because they have been growing actually quite rapidly. Now, it is true, first of all, the empirical regularity is that authoritarian regimes don't have any advantage over democratic regimes in terms of how much growth that they produce. Okay. What you do get is that there is much greater variability of performance in authoritarian regimes than there is under democratic regimes. That's sort of like, you know, it's a lottery. You're picking a dictator. And sometimes you get a good dictator and he does the good thing and you get a high growth, and sometimes you get Mobutu. and you're just unlucky. Now, the virtue of democracy is that, you know, your leaders may not be always, you know, the Socratic, you know, the Platonic guardians that you may want, But you know, if you get somebody really bad, you can kick them out of office. So what you get is you know, you get sort of the mean performance of all other regimes, but with much less variance around that mean. I would make one further point. I would say that I don't think China's economic performance, superior economic performance, is strictly linked to the fact that it was an authoritarian regime. Because if you think about why might an authoritarian regime plausibly have an advantage over a democratic regime, then you would say, but you know, an authoritarian regime can do anything that it wants. You know, if there's a block, somebody's blocking a reform, it can simply, you know, decide to, you know, remove their rents or their privileges and impose costs on certain groups that a democracy cannot, because in a democracy those groups will block it. Well, the if indeed, you know, authoritarian regimes sometimes do better because they can overcome resistance to reform by disenfranchising economically certain groups, then what you would expect to see is that in those successful authoritarian regimes like China and Vietnam, you've had huge redistributions of income. In fact, the whole style of reform in China was to prevent imposing losses on people. And that's been the characteristic. So in many ways, the Chinese reform strategy has worked to ensure something that you sort of habitually think democracies do, which is to actually prevent certain groups from necessarily suffering. I've gone on too much.
Well, we're almost out of time. And in order to be fair to all of you up there, I'm afraid I won't be able to allow any of you to ask a question. We have to finish at 8 for staffing reasons. And so we have 1 minute left, so let me abuse the positions of the chair and ask you one question, which is an absent guest at the feast this evening, to some extent, and it seems slightly unfair to ask you a question about something you haven't talked about, but the absent guest is issues of sustainability, environmental degradation, the challenges of global warming, and so on. You've emphasized increasing and different ways in which countries can grow more. But surely one of the challenges of a development is to create sustainable development paths and resource use patterns and environmental regulations that will shape that in a way that we need to shape now, because we know there's a continuing generalization of existing patterns of resource use and so on are probably unsustainable in the decades ahead. How does the issues of sustainability and environmental degradation, particularly global warming, impact on your recommendations? 30 seconds. I was just looking for a strategy rather than a definitive answer.
Well, I mean, I will be really partly a hardcore economist on this, and I will say I think for most, certainly small developing countries, not all, for most of them, I don't think this is a binding constraint at the moment. I think it's highly unfair to sort of, you know, reduce their economic possibilities and therefore, unfortunately, sort of undercut any sort of possibility of poverty reduction by sort of, you know, if it is indeed not a binding constraint, to take it very seriously. Now, on global warming, I would say that look, you know, this is in large part a consequence of centuries of the Industrial Revolution, centuries of development in the advanced countries, and they have now gotten rich. And advanced countries ought to bear the disproportionate cost of reducing emissions. And I think that's just, you know, so clear cut to me that I'm just you know, totally confused by the discussion on these issues. But maybe that's because I don't understand environmental policy very well.
Somehow I don't think that's likely. All right, well, many thanks.